One of the reasons we know the church isn't going anywhere is because it's built on the unshakable foundation of the permanence and the righteousness of God.
Welcome to Light the Way, featuring the verse-by-verse Bible teaching of Dr. Colin Monger, Senior Pastor at Shepherd of the Hills Church. Jesus said, "You're the light of the world," and that's what we want to help you be. And one way you can shine your light is by supporting this program. Become a Light Partner, and with your monthly support, you'll be helping us reach the world with the gospel. In addition to reaching others, new Light Partners receive a free copy of Dr. Monger's book, Meet Jesus, looking at the seven signs and I Am statements in the Gospel of John. If you'd like more information about the ministry or to become a Light Partner, log on to www.lighttheway.radio.org. But right now, join us as we open our Bibles and begin.
And if you brought your Bibles, would you open to Revelation chapter 6? The book of Revelation chapter 6. There's a story of a man who died and he went to heaven. When he got to heaven, he was met by an angel who said, "I need you to tell me the kindest deed you ever committed. What was the most selfless act of your life?" And the man said, "Well, that's not hard to remember. I was walking out of a restaurant one day and I noticed an old woman was being mugged by three burly biker guys. 6'5", 300 pounds, tattoos, muscles, leather jackets, motorcycles, and they had her cornered into this building and they were mugging her." And so the angel said, "Wow, that's terrible. What did you do?" And he said, "I didn't even think twice. I sprung into action. I hit the biggest guy as hard as I could. The other two, I pushed them away. I knocked over the motorcycles to create a diversion. The old woman was able to escape." And the angel said, "Wow, that was pretty brave. When did this happen?" And the man checked his watch and he said, "About 3 minutes ago." There's a country song by Aaron Tippin that goes, "You've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything." Well, as believers, we are called to stand for something. The Apostle Paul tells us in 2 Thessalonians 2, "So then, brothers, stand firm." We're called to stand for the case of Christ. We're called to live and preach and confess and obey and shine the light of Jesus into the world around us and to do so boldly. Jesus said in Mark 16, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to the whole creation." Be bold about that. In Acts chapter 1, he says, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth." Everywhere we go, we are called to be bold witnesses standing for Christ. But you should be aware that when you do that, you mark yourself. And that mark is used by the world as a target. Jesus said in Matthew 5, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake." When you live a righteous life and you shine that light and you stand out from the crowd, you will be marked. And when that happens, you will face ridicule. I've titled this message, "High Ground in Low Times," because at some point or another, every person who chooses to follow in the footsteps of Jesus Christ will face ridicule for that decision. The world will target you. Since 1950, more than 10 million Christians have been killed worldwide for their faith. It's about 156,000 per year since 1950. So now for 68, almost 69 years, that's been happening. That's more people than in the first 300 years of the church's existence. And yet what we see time and time and time again is places in the world where persecution is the highest, the church is the strongest. It doesn't retreat. It stands that high ground. And we get to see that happen here in Revelation 6, because at this point in what we will call future history, things that haven't happened yet, the persecution of the church is at an all-time high. And yet we see the strength of the church is also at an all-time high. Notice what it says in chapter 6 in verse 5. "When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a black horse. And its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth. You know, one of the things we see as we look at the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as they're often referred to as, all the problems they bring, all the issues that follow them come in a very systematic way. And I say that because if you notice the very first horse, the white horse, what did he bring? Peace on earth, didn't he? It even says back in verse 2, I looked and a white horse and its rider had a bow and a crown was given to him. This guy brings world peace to a chaotic system. But remember, it isn't real, because the very next rider, the red horseman, it says in verse 4, was permitted to take peace from the earth. And so we have a scene where the rapture has happened. Millions of believers have been removed from the earth. They're in heaven. They're worshiping. We've seen them already. And now the world is in chaos. And in comes a knight on a white horse who says, I can fix it all. Just follow me. And the world does. And he does fix it all for a time. Probably a very short period of time. Maybe just a few months. Because then peace is taken. And the world goes from world peace to world war almost overnight. Which brings us to our next horseman, the first one we're looking at this week. Notice in verse 5, it says he's a black horse. And the rider had a pair of scales in his hands. You know, few things are more disruptive to the world's economic system than a major war. You think about it, when world wars break out, tourism declines. International trade declines. Stocks plummet because nobody knows what's going to happen. Oil prices skyrocket. Inflation is out of control. Goods and resources are rationed to the populace. And that's exactly what these scales represent. This is the world's economic system of trade, something that affects every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. And in fact, these scales kind of point us back to a time when that's how goods would be traded. You would have a scale and you would put on one side however much you were trying to buy, and on the other side would come a weight, and however much weight needed or was needed to balance the scale, that represented how much money you would pay. And so you can imagine how important it was for weights to be honest and true, because if you didn't trust the weight system, you wouldn't make the purchase. And if you didn't make the purchase, the person couldn't earn a living. And if they couldn't earn a living, they would be in poverty and the whole economy crashes. In Proverbs 11, it says, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. And yet during this time of tribulation, that's exactly what the enemy attacks. The system of economic success. But it doesn't stop there. Notice how it goes on in verse 8, and it says, a pale horse. His rider's name was Death. Hades followed him, and they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill. 25% of the population killed by that horse. During World War II, it's estimated upwards of 80 million people were killed over 6 years, from the time that Germany first invaded, I believe it was Poland, until the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, somewhere around 80 million people died. 50 million of those were civilians. These are people not fighting. These are not combatants. They're not armed, and yet they died in the bombings and the fires. They died from stray rounds and disease and hunger, being exposed to the elements because the homes had been destroyed. A major war has the ability to affect life on a global scale. And so we have a very systematic approach. We have peace, a false sense of security, which leads the world into the greatest war it's ever seen, which causes hunger and famine on scales never seen, which brings economic depression and then death. It's a very systematic approach. And that's how the enemy often works, isn't it? He likes to do the most damage with the least effort. Talking about World War II, but did you know that World War I actually started almost by accident? If you're a history buff, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But World War I was triggered because the man chauffeuring Archduke Ferdinand of Austria was supposed to take one turn down a road that was vacant of all cars, and instead he took another turn. He made a wrong turn, just an honest mistake, but it landed them in a traffic jam. And so there they are, sitting in a traffic jam, no escort, no bulletproof glass back then, just kind of exposed to the area. And lo and behold, in a shop across the road is a young 19-year-old man by the name of Gavrilo Princip. Well, that man was from Bosnia. And Bosnia and Austria weren't getting along, and Gavrilo Princip was part of an assassins group. And he looks up and he says, Archduke Ferdinand, the leader of Austria, sitting right there. And so he takes the opportunity. He grabs his rifle, he takes the shot, and it triggers World War I. It was in World War I that a young German enlisted soldier by the name of Adolf Hitler started getting the idea that Germany should rule the world. And the rest, as we know, is history. The point is this. It doesn't always take a lot to get us off course. Sometimes it's just a nudge and the dominoes start to fall. And that's often how the enemy works. It's just a nudge. It's just one compromise, just one decision, just one bad choice, and then comes another, and then another, and then another. And before long, you don't even know where you've come from. And here's the lesson for us in all of that, because we won't be around during this, but we are here now, and this has something to teach us. You can't control what happens to you in life. We can't control the circumstances of the world, but we can control our response. There's an old saying that goes, life is 10% what happens and 90% what you do about it. You can choose how to respond. Paul tells us in Ephesians 6 to put on the whole armor of God that you may withstand the schemes of the devil. They're there. But it's our choice to withstand them. It's our choice to react. And whether something systematically builds you up or systematically tears you down, ultimately that's up to you. And so this is a systematic approach. We have peace and then war and then hunger and then death. But it's also a systemic attack. In other words, it's not a surface level thing. This isn't something that just passes over. This doesn't just disrupt the world's economy. It corrupts it to its core. And we know that because of what it says in verse 6. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. And do not harm the oil and wine. If you think back to the book of Genesis, and I know if you come Wednesday nights, then this might be a bad memory, but we've been in Genesis. We just finished, but it was about a year. But if you think back to the very beginning, Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve in the garden, Satan finds Eve by herself, and he tempts her to eat from the forbidden tree. Now, it wasn't just that Eve ate from the tree. It wasn't just that she made a mistake. I've heard people say before, what's the big deal? It was just a piece of fruit. Wasn't that an overreaction? It wasn't just that she had an oops. It was that in the moment that she disobeyed God, the whole system was corrupted. The physical and spiritual genetic structure of the human race was changed. Not only Adam and Eve, but every person after them would be infected. They lost their relationship with God, and that's what they passed on to their children and their children's children. And that one event was so transformational, so corruptive, that it changed the very nature of humans. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 5, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? It just takes a little bit, but it's able to corrupt the whole thing. And that's exactly what we see Satan doing here during the tribulation with the economy, with the world, corrupting the whole thing. And we see that because of, notice the cost. It says a quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. Now, just to put that in some general terms, a denarius was a day's wage. That's what an average person could expect to take home at the end of the day. A quart of wheat was barely enough to make enough bread for one person to live that day. And so what you see is your entire day's wage would go to feed yourself for that one day. So you could barely make it if you were single. But if you had a wife and you had kids at home, maybe you had family you were taking care of, there is no way you could feed them all. It would be impossible. And so what people will do at that time is they'll go to barley. That's the example. Because you can get three times the barley as you can wheat. The problem was barley was usually used for animal feed, but it wasn't starving. It was something. It didn't taste the best, but it was there. It was better than nothing at all. But there's something else we notice in this, and I actually see this as a bit of an encouragement. And notice how verse 6 ends, "And do not harm the oil or wine." Now, some people see that and they see a command. Don't mess with that. But you know, I look at that and I see a grace. I see mercy. Because you can have all the barley in the world. You can have all the wheat in the world. But if you don't have oil, you can't make bread. And you can have all the water in the world. But back during the time when this was written, if you didn't have wine to purify that water, you couldn't drink it either. That's why Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 5, don't drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and frequent ailments. They didn't have clean water like we have. They had to purify it. And so if you didn't have oil, if you didn't have wine, you would starve and die of thirst. And so, like I say, I see this as a grace. I see this as an act of God's mercy that says even when there's nothing we can do to overcome our situation, God can. Even when we can't make ends meet, when the numbers don't add up at the end of the month, God has the ability to sovereignly intervene. And here's the application. Just because it didn't happen the way you intended, or just because it didn't go the way you thought, doesn't mean God failed. Just because it doesn't look like we imagined it would look, doesn't mean God abandoned you. There's a story of a man who was working two jobs to make ends meet. And he was working 16-hour days, going from one to the next, 7 days a week. He was never home. He could barely make rent. He could barely put food on the table and keep a roof over the heads of his family. And so he went to his pastor and he said, "I'm really struggling here. Because you always talk about how God will meet my needs. And yet, look, I'm working myself like a dog. And I can barely keep up." And the pastor said, "Well, I think you've got it all wrong. I think God knew one job wasn't enough. And so he gave you a second one so that you could meet your needs." You know, I imagine during this period of tribulation, there's going to be a lot of people in the world just like that man, living on barley, wondering what happened, where is God? And yet even in the midst of all of that, he's still sovereign. And so it says, "Do not harm the oil and wine." That's a mercy. And so it's a systematic approach. It's a systemic attack. And finally, as we close, notice in the middle of all of that comes a sacrificial action. Verse 9. "When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, 'O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?' Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been." I saw on Facebook a couple of days ago, it is now, a picture of a sign welcoming people into Pennsylvania. It's just one of those signs on the road, on the highway, when you cross the state line. And it said, "Pennsylvania, pursue your happiness." And I thought, that's it. That is the message of the world in a nutshell, is it not? Pursue your happiness. Do what makes you feel good. That's the same message we hear on TV. We hear it on the radio. And in movies, it's on the internet, it's on social media, It's in magazines. It's everywhere. Do what makes you happy. And even more than that, as a United States citizen, you have a constitutional right to do what makes you happy. You have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Pennsylvania, pursue your happiness. And so it's strange for us when we read things like this passage we've just read, because it's all about sacrifice. It's not about finding your personal happiness. It's about putting yourself last. And yet I would submit to you that the very mark of true faith is the willingness to say no to self. Jesus told us in Luke chapter 9, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Faith in Jesus Christ is all about pursuing God's will, not our happiness. And that's exactly what we see going on here. During this time of tribulation, the worst time the world will ever see, despite pressure from the world to give it up, despite persecution of those who have not, despite the personal risk and loss, millions and millions and millions of people are running right into the arms of Jesus Christ. The church will never be stronger than it is right then. And we know that because of what it says later on in chapter 7 in verse 9. After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands. Down in verse 13 it says, then one of the elders addressed me, saying, who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come? I said to him, sir, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. Tribulation saints, people who did not believe before the rapture, but after that and seeing what they've seen, have flocked to Christ. And so you may have a false peace, and you may have world war, and you may have unmatched depression, and you may have unmatched death and suffering, but in the middle of all of that pressure, you have the greatest revival the world will ever see. And for every person running into God's arms, it would appear there is someone running away. Notice how it goes on to say in verse 15, then the kings of the earth, the great ones, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, and everyone, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? You know, any time a person finds themselves in a crisis situation, something stressful, your body responds. And what happens is your nervous system releases hormones that stimulate your adrenal glands. Those adrenal glands then turn you into something called the flight or fight response. Some people run toward a challenge and other people run away, they retreat. And spiritually, we have the same thing. Whenever crisis strikes, there are some people who use that as an opportunity to run right to God for protection. And yet others will use it as an opportunity to run away. But I have observed, usually the people who run from God are the ones who spend their time blaming God. They'll shake their fist and they'll say, this is your fault. It's your fault I'm going through this. And they'll have that kind of anger in them. And they'd be the same type of people that rather than running to God for help, would run into a mountain and pray to be killed rather than face Jesus. And so it says that's exactly what they did. They cried out, fall on us and hide us from the Lamb. How do you respond in crisis? How do you respond when trouble strikes and you didn't see it coming? We all have that. You go home and the water heater blew up. Or you get a call from someone in your family and now there's drama that you didn't see. Or the doctor gives you some surprise in the mail or over the phone or even in person. How do you respond when crisis strikes? When a job you thought you'd have forever is now on the line, or maybe it's been lost. When money you needed to come in doesn't show up. How do you respond when times are low? Do you fall on your knees in prayer? Or do you shake your fists in anger? How do you react? You know, there's a lot of things in life we have no control over. We cannot control whether bad things happen, because they will. We cannot force people to love one another. We can't stop all crime from happening. There's things in life that no matter how much we would like to, we just cannot control. But what you can control is how you respond. You can decide to take a stand for Jesus. And you can choose to take the high ground even when times are low.